Well, I think it's human nature that we all want to do things for ourselves. We like to think that we can do it. We can achieve it on our own. We can earn it. And that way we get the praise. We get the glory. I know that's definitely true of me, naturally. Whatever it is that I'm doing, I don't need any help. I can do it all on my own. And the absolute last thing that I want to do is have to admit that I can't do something. And my little nephew, Leo, who's almost two, he has the exact same problem. He loves to say, "Leo, do it," even when Leo really can't do it. So the other day, my sister got a Capri Sun out of her bag, and she pops in the straw and holds it out in front of him to drink. But instead of putting his lips around the straw, he says, "Leo, do it," because Leo wants to hold the Capri Sun himself. But those of you that have seen toddlers will know that a Capri Sun and a toddler is not a very good mix, because the second Leo gets his little hands around the Capri Sun, well, he's going to squeeze it all over himself. But he's a stubborn toddler, so he continues, "Leo, do it, Leo, do it." And eventually my sister gives up, hands him the Capri Sun, and immediately half of it is all over his lap. Well, if you were here with us last Sunday evening, you'll remember that we were looking at the first half of Mark chapter 2. And we saw that Jesus has authority to forgive sins. And he proved it by healing the paralyzed man. And then we also saw Jesus calling Levi, the tax collector of all people. And the scribes of the Pharisees, well, they got pretty annoyed about that, because Jesus, he was feasting with the wrong people. He was eating with the lawbreakers, like Levi, tax collectors and sinners, instead of them, the righteous ones. And we ended on Jesus' slightly sarcastic reply to the religious leaders in verse 17. He says he didn't come for the righteous. Or at least he didn't come for those who think they're righteous. No, he came for the sinners. He came as a doctor to heal those who recognize their sinners in need of forgiveness. Well, today we discover why the religious leaders don't think they're sinners. Why they don't think they need Jesus. And it's our age-old human problem. They think they can do it themselves. They think they're doing fine just as they are. In fact, we'll see this evening that they actually think they're doing even better than Jesus. And they start questioning him about his actions and those of his disciples. This section that we've been looking at last Sunday and tonight is made up of five stories. So if you go back a page to the start of Mark chapter 1, you'll see that we begin with Jesus healing a paralytic. That's story one. Then Jesus calls Levi. Then we have a question about fasting. Jesus is Lord of the Sabbath. And a man with a withered hand. And in each story, there's some sort of back and forth between Jesus and the religious leaders. Some people call these the five conflict stories or the five controversy stories. But it doesn't really matter what you call them. What's important to see is that this is Jesus versus the religious leaders. And there are five rounds. So last Sunday we looked at the first two, and tonight we're looking at the last three. Can we get the slide up on the screen, please? Because it seems like these five stories are arranged in a certain way. Here's a little diagram. Hopefully you can see what that says. So we've got our five stories, 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. And the red line going along the bottom, well, that's showing the link between the first and the last story. Both of those stories involve healing miracles. Story number 2 is about eating with sinners. Story number 4 is about sinning by eating, as we'll see this evening. And we've got the blue line going across those two. And in this unit, this section, Jesus makes two authority claims about himself. The Son of Man, as he calls himself. The first one we saw last week, that was in verse 10, and that's the green line going along the left-hand side, holding together stories 1 and 2. Jesus, the Son of Man, claims to have authority to forgive sins. And then Jesus' second authority claim is shown by the orange line on the right-hand side. That comes in verse 28 this evening, holding together stories 4 and 5. And that's what we're going to look at now. So we'll come back to the important middle story, story 3, in a bit. But for now, we're looking at Mark chapter 2, verses 23, going down to 3, verse 6. And the Son of Man's second authority claim, that Jesus has authority over the law. So if you're taking notes, that's our first point this evening. Jesus has authority over the law. You can get rid of the slide now, please, Ellie. Verse 23 begins with Jesus and his disciples walking through some cornfields on the Sabbath. And the Pharisees must have been there too, because it says when they saw Jesus' disciples plucking some ears of corn, they jumped in saying, "Look, why are they doing what is not lawful on the Sabbath?" It certainly seems like the Pharisees were trying to catch Jesus out here, like they're just hanging around and waiting for him to slip up in their eyes. They're trying to expose Jesus, trying to show everyone that he and his disciples are lawbreakers. Well, Jesus responds by asking them if they've never read about what David did, how when he was hungry and in need, he ate the temple bread that only the priests were allowed to eat, and also gave some to his men. And I'll admit that that's a pretty confusing answer. If I could ask Jesus one question about this passage, I think it'd be what he means with this David bit, because I spent a long time this week trying to get my head around that and exactly what he's saying, and I wasn't really able to land anywhere. And we don't have time to go through all the potential possibilities. If you want to chat to me about that afterwards, that would be great. But whatever it is, it doesn't change his two closing remarks. The first one we see in verse 27. So Jesus said to the Pharisees, "The Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath." Well, I was in Germany last year for a mate's wedding, and one of the first culture shocks that I noticed out there was to do with how people treat the green man at a pedestrian crossing. So over here, if you come to a busy road and you press the button and you wait for the green man, then it will tell you when to cross. But you know, if there's a quiet road and there's no cars, you just walk across and it's fine. Over there, they press the button and they wait, even if there's not a single car in sight. And there were a few times where a group of us would get to a crossing, and there'd already be about 10 people there waiting. And you'd look left and you'd look right, and it's a long, straight road, and there's not a car to be seen, and yet everyone is just standing there, waiting for the green man. And to me, at least, it felt a bit like something out of a dystopian nightmare. I was kind of looking around, desperate to move. But apparently, my German friend told me that if you do move, if you do cross on the red man, there's a good chance you're going to get a telling off from one of the pedestrians on the other side, in German, of course. And at worst, if you're caught by someone official, they'll give you a fine for jaywalking. Well, in the UK, thankfully, I guess, our lawmakers have remembered that pedestrian crossings were invented to help pedestrians cross the road. They weren't invented to prevent pedestrians from crossing empty roads. And it's all about getting the order right. So what the Pharisees had done to the Sabbath is very similar. The Sabbath was created by God for man. It was created to give them rest. No more would they have to work 7 day weeks like they'd been doing when they were slaves in Egypt. But the Pharisees had added loads of extra bits onto God's law, so much so that according to them, you were breaking the law even if you just plucked and ate a few bits of corn as you walked through a field on the Sabbath. That was work according to the Pharisees. But Jesus didn't think so. And the question is, who gets to decide what's lawful and what is not lawful? Who has the authority regarding the law? Is it Jesus or is it the religious leaders? Well, in verse 28, Jesus clearly claims that he has authority over the law. The Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. So the Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath. Jesus seems to be saying that if the Sabbath was made for man, and if he is the Son of Man, the one who is given all authority in Daniel 7, well then he's the one with authority over the Sabbath. He's the one that gets to decide. Well, chapter 3 begins again with Jesus going about his business, and the religious leaders are watching him. They're waiting for him to do something they consider to be work on the Sabbath. And they must have been absolutely rubbing their hands together when they spotted a man with a withered hand. This is exactly what they've been waiting for. Jesus will heal him. They can expose him as a Sabbath breaker and a law breaker. But this time we'll see that Jesus gets in there first. And instead of the religious leaders exposing Jesus as a lawbreaker, he turns the tables on them and he exposes the evil inside their hearts. So Jesus says to them in verse 4, "Is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good or to do harm, to save life or to kill?" Well, it's a pretty straightforward question. We all know what the correct answer is. But it says that the Pharisees were silent. You see, the last thing they wanted to do was publicly admit that Jesus was right and their strict Sabbath rules were wrong. With one question, Jesus has exposed the Pharisees' hard hearts. They care more about their rules than helping the needy. And that rightly makes Jesus angry. So he does good on the Sabbath. He heals the man with just a few words. He isn't breaking any of God's laws anyway. But the Pharisees, they hate him for it. After the miracle, there's no amazement. There's no glorifying God like we saw last week. Instead, verse 6, immediately the Pharisees held counsel with the Herodians against Jesus, how to destroy him. And the reason they hate Jesus so much is because he's claiming to be the one with authority over the law. He's saying, "I'm the ultimate judge of what is or isn't lawful, not the religious leaders." But why does Jesus have authority over the law, something that belongs to God? And from last week, why does Jesus have authority to forgive sins, something that only God can do? Well, we find the answers to those questions in story number 3, the middle story of the 5. So do look back with me at Mark 2, starting at verse 18, and the question about fasting. So for context here, God's actual biblical law required that his people fast on one day of the year, and that was the Day of Atonement. That was the one day each year when the high priest could enter the most holy of holies in the temple and make a sacrifice for the sins of the people. But the Pharisees, well, they decided that on top of that, good Jews should also fast for 2 days each week, sort of like an early version of the 5-2 diet. But they're not fasting to lose weight. No, they thought that fasting was their way of trying to earn special favor with God. They thought that God would be impressed with them for going above and beyond what the law actually required. And they'd also show off about the fact that they were fasting to others too, to try and impress them. So Mark 2 verse 8, John's disciples and the disciples of the Pharisees were fasting, as all good Jews should be doing. But Jesus' disciples weren't. And naturally some people came and asked Jesus, "Why aren't your disciples fasting? What's different about your lot?" And Jesus' answer is fascinating. He says, verse 19, "Can the wedding guests fast while the bridegroom is with them? As long as they have the bridegroom with them, they cannot fast." Well, reading that always reminds me of when I was a teenager in church and I first heard the word bridegroom, because I thought it was some kind of combo of like bride and groom combined. But it's not. Bridegroom just means groom. I'm sure you all know that. But Jesus is saying here, I am the groom. And if the groom is here, then the wedding guests can't fast. That would just be completely nuts. And Jesus calling himself the bridegroom is very important in itself. He didn't just pick any random happy occasion. He couldn't have said instead, can the party guests fast while the birthday boy is with them? Because even though on the surface that would be making the same point, it would totally miss Jesus's main point. Because as far as I'm aware, there's nowhere in the Old Testament where God is referred to as the birthday boy. But the idea of God as the bridegroom, as husband to his people, well, that's found all over the place. And it goes something like this. God rescued his people from Egypt, and he entered into a covenant relationship with them, much in the same way that a husband and wife enter into a covenant when they get married. But God's people were unfaithful to him. They cheated on God. And because of that, the marriage covenant and the relationship was broken. And since then, God's people have been looking forward to a day when the marriage covenant would be renewed. And their sins, their unfaithfulness to God, their husband, would be forgiven. So that's basically the message of the book of Hosea in a nutshell. We see it as well in Isaiah 62, verse 5. That says, as the bridegroom rejoices over the bride, so shall your God rejoice over you. And we see it as well in Jeremiah 31, which is going to appear up on the screens now. So Jeremiah 31, verses 31 to 34. It says, behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and the house of Judah. Not like the covenant I made with their fathers on the day when I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt. My covenant that they broke, though I was their husband, declares the Lord. But this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, declares the Lord. I will put my law within them, and I will write it on their hearts. And I will be their God, and they shall be my people. And no longer shall each one teach his neighbor and each his brother, saying, know the Lord. For they shall all know me, from the least of them to the greatest, declares the Lord. For I will forgive their iniquity, and I will remember their sin no more. So when Jesus says, the bridegroom is here. That's what he means. He means God is here. Jesus is saying, I am God, and I've come to make a new covenant with my people. This is the moment that Israel have been waiting for. So when the people come and ask Jesus why his disciples aren't fasting, he's like, fasting? Fasting? You want them to be fasting now? This is not the time for fasting. The bridegroom is here. So we saw last week that Jesus has authority to forgive sins. And we've seen today that Jesus has authority over the law. And that's because Jesus is God, come to make a new covenant with his people. Jesus is God, come to make a new covenant with his people. And that covenant is going to involve Jesus, the bridegroom, being taken away. So just as verse 31 in Jeremiah starts, behold, the days are coming. Well, so Mark 2, verse 20 says, the days will come when the bridegroom is taken away from them, and then they will fast in that day. We haven't yet been told exactly how Jesus is going to bring about this new covenant. We're still only in chapter 2 of Mark's Gospel, after all. But this is our first hint that it will involve Jesus dying. And perhaps there's even a hint here that Jesus' death will act as a once and for all new Day of Atonement type sacrifice. Remember, I said that the law stated that the one day when God's people had to fast was the Day of Atonement. And here Jesus says, when talking about his being taken away, that they will fast in that day. And then verses 21 and 22 show us that this new covenant that Jesus is bringing, well, it's going to be totally new. This isn't just some second chance at keeping the original covenant again. No, this is something completely new and completely incompatible with the old. So that's what Jesus is getting at with the new cloth and the old garment and the new wine and the old wineskins. You can't combine new with old. It just doesn't work. So if you put your patched up old jumper into the washing machine, well, the new patch is going to shrink and tear away from the rest of the old jumper. And apparently if you put new wine into old wineskins that have already been stretched to their limits, well, the wineskins are going to burst like a balloon once the new wine starts fermenting and expanding inside them. And the new covenant, the new way of relating to God that Jesus is bringing, well, it's totally new and totally incompatible with the old way. And that's why the religious leaders, the Pharisees, they hate Jesus so much. They're the gatekeepers of the old way. They're all about making yourself righteous by keeping the law. But we know that the old way doesn't work. As Paul says in Romans 3, no one is righteous. No, not one. No one understands. No one seeks God. All have turned aside. See, a new way was needed, and a new way has come, we see in this passage. Jesus, the bridegroom, has come. But he will be rejected by some. The Pharisees reject him, and in doing so, they reject God and his offer of a restored relationship. I heard someone say about this passage that to attempt to hold on to the old way at the same time as following Jesus is as foolish and impossible as attempting to get onto a bus while still holding on to the bus stop. It just can't be done. It's one or the other. But we don't need to hold on to the bus stop, because the bridegroom is here. So from this point on, it's all about Jesus. Jesus is God, come to make a new covenant with his people. He's the one with authority to forgive us our sins. He's the one who forgives, who fulfills the law on our behalf. The old has been replaced by the new. The law has been replaced by the gospel. Through Jesus, we can now have an intimate, personal relationship with God again. And if we're trusting in Jesus, well then, that's something for us to be massively excited about, to rejoice in. And we can look forward to that final wedding that's described to us in the book of Revelation. Revelation 19, verse 7. John writes this: let us rejoice and exult and give him the glory, for the marriage of the Lamb has come, and his bride has made herself ready. It was granted for her to clothe herself with fine linen, bright and pure, for the fine linen is the righteous deeds of the saints. And the angel said to me, write this: blessed are those who are invited to the marriage supper of the Lamb.